The thrill and excitement of March Mania is here, and DraftKings Sportsbook, one of America's top-rated sportsbook apps, is giving new customers a shot to turn $5 into $150 instantly in bonus bets with any college basketball bet. You can find all the lines and available odds, of course, at the DraftKings Sportsbook app. North Carolina listeners, don't forget, DraftKings Sportsbook is now live in your state. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code SBNFL. New customers can bet $5 to get $150 instantly in bonus bets only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code SBNFL. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction, void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/bball for eligibility, deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Hey everyone, how's it going? It's Anthony Cazenza with the Orange and Black Insider Bengals podcast and CincyJungle.com. I hope that you're doing well. I hope that you have enjoyed this past week since we've last taken the air. I hope that you have been enjoying yourself, hopefully got a little relaxation, not too much work, but have also taken in all the sights and sounds of our wonderful show. And with me as always is John Sheeran. John, how's it going, my friend?
It's going about as well as it could be because we are in the middle of a tsunami in Cincinnati. It's going to rain for the next 4 days. It's already rained for the past half week. And just like the women's national team is raining on everybody in Paris, we got the dominance over there. So it's all good for me right now.
I like it. I like it. I wanted to kind of start off with some positive vibes, I guess, that have been surrounding the Cincinnati Bengals. And
we need some of those.
I know, because, you know, we go through this. We've been going through this season, and I think a lot of people, national media members, casual NFL fans, you know, whoever, a lot of people have not been high on the Cincinnati Bengals for a variety of reasons. They think it's going to be a year of transition because of the coaching overhaul. Certain stars they've had are getting older. There are questions with their starting quarterback. You know, the list kind of goes on and on. Somehow a lot of folks still think that this team that has most of its players intact and have done some additions on the offensive line, which, by the way, is another question mark on this team. Somehow a lot of folks think that with a new coach and guys coming back from injury, that this team will somehow be worse than the 6-10 team that we saw last year, with all those injuries and everything. Go figure. But we've kind of been hearing all offseason that that's been the case, right? It's not a lot of optimism. You know, that this is probably going to be a rebuild year. Look to the next year or two for potentially another quarterback. That sort of thing. Well, recently, really over the past week or handful of days, there's been more positive news, or I guess a new flurry of positive news that have come about the Cincinnati Bengals. A couple of them have come from NFL.com, and another has come from Pro Football Focus. John, if it's okay with you, and hopefully this thing cues up well enough, I want to play a video clip from the NFL Network. Good Morning Football. It's a little bit through the kind of the segment on the Bengals. They are labeling the Bengals a sleeper team. Kyle Brandt, who's on the show, he kind of had an interesting I'm going to skip that part, but kind of an interesting take to open the segment. Kay Adams talked about that she's interested in the Bengals this year. Nate Burleson wasn't as high on the team, but Peter Schrager, which is the part I'm going to get to here, talking about Zach Taylor and the Bengals and a little bit of positivity in terms of, so we're going to start with this. We've got another article, another couple of articles, and we'll kind of break this down and talk about you know, where these are coming from. Are they founded? Is it just idle chatter? That sort of thing. So I'm going to cue this up here.
Yeah, and if you don't know Zach Taylor and his background, everyone gives McVay and LaFleur this credit for what the Rams were. Zach Taylor was a guy that was with that team, and Zach Taylor was in the ear of Jared Goff just about every single play last season for the Rams. And this is not a crazy hire because he is the next one. He's been the one that's been ascending for a long time. It was a great hire. And Katie, your point, it's just new energy. Mm-hmm. It's new energy. I don't know if I would say it's they had the two beds with Marvin Lewis in the bedroom, but I would say it got a little stale.
Yeah, they had the couch.
They had the couch, baby. Yeah,
trust me.
At the very least, there's a fresh new energy. He's 35 years old.
Yeah.
35 years old. I mean, that would make him a very young coach in any sport. You put him in football, he's the second youngest.
Yeah, that's like a Cabana boy right there.
That's exactly right. So is he ready to go up against Harbaugh and Tomlin and even Freddie Kitchens?
Yeah, okay.
We'll see. Yeah. But they've got a good staff around him, and the players are talking, and they're saying the right things. They're a perfect sleeper team right now in June where no one's talking about them. That's exactly where they want to be.
So, you know, it's a five-minute segment. I could sit here and, you know, really – play the whole thing for you, and I guess it would make our job a lot easier. But I wanted to start off with that, and we'll kind of build a bit more with these other articles I'm talking about. But your thoughts on that? By the way, if you're wondering, John, what that comment about the beds and the couch and all that stuff, that Kyle Brandt made an odd metaphor with Marvin Lewis and the team kind of being old-fashioned and buttoned up and doing a Leave It to Beaver type of reference. Watch the clip. It's interesting. It's funny. But your thoughts on kind of what Peter Schrager said, and really, I mean, the title of the segment is, are the Bengals legitimate AFC North contenders, question mark? And there are a lot of comments there saying, yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of able to put that two beds comment together. But something interesting he said, I would hope he's ready to compete with Freddie Kitchens, because I don't think Kitchens has established himself at all in any regards. At least he has the experience of an interim head coach, but he's definitely not up there with Tomlin and Harbaugh and whatever. But, you know, it's nice to hear Schrager say that. I believe he was a fan of the Bengals back in the 90s. I think he has some sort of connection with the team in itself or with the city of Cincinnati. But he's been on, I think, the Zach Taylor train since the hire was made official back in February. Going back to just how Taylor kind of rose up to the spot and how he became in position to become the Bengals head coach. And everything that's happened since has kind of really reaffirmed, I think, his overall view of the hire in itself. And like I think you said it perfectly, just energy, because that's been the one constant coming out of not only the players' mouths, but also the coaches' mouths, too, because I think Paul Danner Jr. put out something for The Athletic about how the seven assistant coaches who were with Marvin Lewis last year, what their take is on Zach Taylor's system and this process and his coaching style. And it's been nothing but positives with that. So the players and the coaches are kind of on the same page with this new direction that they're taking. And it's a reinvigoration of that entire process of what's going on in that locker room. And I think that's definitely the point that he's hammering home really loudly at this point. And I think it's reaffirming what he has been saying since the beginning of the offseason and what a lot of us have been saying. It's just a fresh change. And that is the one thing that can ignite a team that's been stale, that's been, you know, stuck in the rut for these past 3 years. And something that can potentially take them to a place that they haven't been there before. Obviously, all the pieces have to come together, but we'll get to other points of why this team is obviously a tremendous candidate to be a positive regression team. And I think Schrager basically hit it with the umbrella point about this is a type of change that needed to happen for them to take over, you know, the Steelers, the Ravens, the usual faces at the top of the division to do things that they haven't been able to do before under Marvin Lewis. And I think that's basically like the genesis of why it's important to have a coach like Zach Taylor take over for, you know, the same old Marvin Lewis song and dance we've seen for the past 16 years.
I think in the theme you're kind of seeing or hearing from some of these things in Zach Taylor is relatable. His ability to relate to the players, both from a teaching and X's and O's standpoint, as well as, the ability to, I think there was something referenced in the video. It wasn't in the clip that I played, but, there's something to the effect of, you know, players are actually a little bit more engaging in social media. They're just doing different things. And I think you're seeing a team that is responding to a coaching staff that was stubborn, that was stuck in their ways. And I think a lot of that reflected on the field. I think, you know, and they're stuck in their ways about the players that they drafted and the players they brought in, the players they decided to re-sign, the free agents they decided to bring in. Now, there wasn't an absolute overhaul on the free agency front in this new regime or anything like that. But the character thing, I think that's something to be noted. You just look at it, and I think it's just kind of a pushing of the reset button, so to speak, and players are just responding to that. You're seeing a lot of complimentary things coming from the team. And now I almost wonder if those are trickling over to the national media and, as to why some of these people are now jumping on the Bengals bandwagon a little bit. I don't want to overstate this, but the other article or one article I wanted to talk about, it was very interesting. And you can actually find the video clip that I played there on this article. It's State of the Franchise, Bengals a Sneaky Sleeper in 2019. This is by Adam Rank, who hasn't been the most complimentary guy towards the Bengals over the years. And this is on NFL.com. And if you know Adam Rank, he's a pretty interesting guy in how he speaks and writes and all that kind of stuff.
He's a Bears homer too. So
yeah, he is a Bears guy. I mean, this is a really long, and I have to give him credit. This is actually very, very well done, very well thought out. It goes from how the Bengals got here, the highs, the lows, 2019 VIPs, the 2019 roadmap, three key games. So, I mean, there's a storyline everyone's overlooking, a storyline that everyone's overthinking. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here. It's a very well thought out piece, but kind of in closing, I thought this was interesting. And again, this isn't overly complimentary, but it's a guy who I guess says he can see light at the end of the tunnel, or the chance that this team could be immediately competitive. And he writes, "I'm approaching the Bengals season much in the same way I approached going to see Aquaman in theaters. I wanted to believe and have optimism, but I didn't get my hopes up. The good news for the Bengals is the division rival Browns have taken all the hype and attention away from them. Taylor is not under major pressure in year one. And the Bengals weren't that bad last season before the injuries piled up. Taylor might be able to mimic the success McVay had right off the bat with the Rams, and the Bengals might just find themselves in the playoff hunt. I mean, stranger things have happened, and I loved Aquaman." So I saw Aquaman, by the way. It was pretty good. I wouldn't say I loved it. But again, it's one of those things where you go, okay, understandable. The skepticism is understandable. I guess the doubts are there, but you also see a guy who sees the potential of this team and can see that, hey, this could be something exciting right away, even though nobody has been talking about them.
Yeah. And I think that's an important point, because now we're starting into the part of the offseason where people are trying to hop on, buy low teams, basically just like stocks, because the whole trend with the NFL playoffs is that on average about 5 to 6 new teams make the playoffs every year. And, however many teams, minus that, miss the playoffs after 1 year. It's very hard to go back to the playoffs back-to-back times. So I think, analysts are looking at the Bengals and they're thinking, okay, this is the team that struggled for the past 3 years. By and large, most of the talent from the past couple of years are still with the team. They're still good players, and some of the negatives from the team basically have been liquidated from the franchise. Basically, most of the bad has been replaced with the good, and most of the good there is still there. So you have a team with a lot of the pieces that are there to make a run, but they just haven't been proven to do that. And that's, I think, comes with the low expectations. You don't expect them to make the playoffs, but if there is a team that could be one of those five teams that didn't make the playoffs last year, the Bengals have a very strong case with that. And another thing is, mimicking the Rams and replicating it to a certain degree of success, I think is a key distinction, because obviously the Rams are as talented as hell and they have multiple Pro Bowlers or should be Pro Bowlers on that offensive roster. And even the quarterback play is definitely in the Rams' favor at the moment, even though Andy Dalton has a number of years on Jared Goff. So that's definitely going to be the key, because we have to assume that the defense is going to be at some degree better, because it was hard to get a lot worse than last year. But the offense could go either way, and it really depends on how that offense, you know, kind of meshes from the beginning, how that system kind of comes together with the pieces there, because at this point the offense is going to have to carry them, because this defense still hasn't proven to be dominant in that way. So I think he harped on the correct point there. If they can mimic the Rams offense and what they do successfully to at least some degree, with some degree of consistency, then they're going to be able to make a push against a fourth place schedule. And I think that's another thing that some people are starting to look at is that the Browns aren't facing this bottom of the AFC teams anymore, because they were in last place last year. That's the Bengals' job now, playing the Bills, playing some other bottom of the league teams. So they're going to have chances to string together wins, and a winning streak was so hard to come by last year, especially towards the end of the year. So, all those factors coming together, I think that's where this low expectation, but potentially, high result is kind of formulating from.
Yeah. And I want to, I want you to talk about the next article, because you were the one who brought it to my attention. But before we do that, I want to go back to what I said about the stubbornness and things of that nature with this team, and where Zach Taylor can potentially make a difference on that front. Now, this staff is losing. It gained experience in some areas in terms of coaches. It lost quite a bit of experience in terms of coaches in other areas, including the head coach. But and experience is to be valued, obviously. Guys are familiar with the NFL, and for all the things we want to harp on about Marvin Lewis, he did have quite a bit of success against the Ravens, against the Browns. We know some of the positive things that he did, and they outweighed the negatives for the most part while he was in Cincinnati. But the one thing I want to talk about with the stubbornness and where Zach Taylor could be making a difference is the in-game stuff, the adjustments, the ability to be a little bit more fluid and less rigid in a game. I can't tell you how often I have thought about the 2013 playoff game against the then San Diego Chargers. That was a game that I think most people felt, especially a home playoff game. I can't tell you how I go back to that so often, because that is a game that I think most people would have thought that the Bengals would have won on their home turf, kind of bad cold weather. They had a talented roster, probably the most talented team aside from 2015 in the recent era. And, they did not get it done. And where you really saw some things were some statements made by Chargers defenders saying, they were throwing things at us that we knew were coming. They didn't make any adjustments from the first time we saw them. They didn't make any adjustments at halftime. Some people buy into that stuff. Some people do not. But I think in this league where, it's a real fast-paced league, it's a knee-jerk reaction league in terms of potential hirings and firings and that sort of thing, you have to be able to be fluid. And I think that probably is one of the things that drew the Bengals to Zach Taylor in terms of hiring, his ability potentially to work with a quarterback, to work with an offense, and now hopefully the rest of the team to transition in game and be a little bit unpredictable.
Yeah, and I have no idea what game you're talking about. I don't remember the Bengals ever losing the playoff game to the Chargers at home. Definitely not without Geno Atkins. That game never happened. Anyways, that was with the 10-year head coach, by the way. And that is a game that would get 31 other head coaches fired. And that was the most frustrating thing with it. It's that the fact that it was year three into this mini rebuild that they had, just the reset of the franchise, and wasn't really resetting anything because all the main problems were still there. So it was just the extra staleness of the franchise. And the fact that it's changing now, I think it's just a wake-up call to most other people. But I'll just say this. If just the casual fan wants two reasons why the Bengals will win more than they did last year, my two things would be injury regression and close wins regression. Two things that have shown over the years that they're not consistent, they're not stable things that go from year to year. A team that is very much injured in one year is typically less injured the next year. That's just natural with the NFL. And also close games is something that you have to take a look at. The Bengals were 2-5 in one score games in the 2018 season. And going back to, I think, 2006, every team that finishes below 500 in one score games ends up winning at least one or two games more in the next season, because what was found in the study was that one score games are essentially coin flips and that they're not consistent going in year to year. So teams who were unlucky in one year typically end up doing better in one score games the next year, and typically will have an increase in overall wins. And when you couple the fact that, yeah, you would hope that some of those problems in-game problems and coaching issues, that they will all be at the very least minimized with a new staff, with a new system in place. Again, you have the same, pretty much the same talent in there. Hopefully you have, you know, more games coming out of AJ Green and Tyler Eifert and Andy Dalton at that point. All those things kind of add up, and you're thinking, okay, maybe it's not crazy to assume that the Bengals can take some jump from the six wins that they had last year. Again, they have to prove it, but I do think that even for a natural pessimist like me, there is a lot of reason for optimism of improvement, not dominance, but just improvement. So when I see, you know, projections of 3-5 wins, I just don't think there's a lot of data behind that.
Right. I kind of, and they also said this, you know, I don't want to steal everything from this video, but it's something I've said before anyway. In this video clip, they kind of, I think it was Kyle Brandt who said, you know, a lot of reasons for this cynicism towards the Bengals is because they fooled us before, and oh, it's the Bengals, right? It's the reasoning for a lot of this stuff is because it's the Bengals, in terms of the negativity. But he said that you got to kind of wipe that from your memory and know that this is a transition. And there was another article you had, I think it was through Pro Football Focus, that not really on the same level in terms of the team being a sleeper team, but it is on the same wavelength in terms of positivity with the team and a little bit of kudos being thrown their way.
Yeah. So this article is not out on Since Jungle yet, but definitely look forward in the coming weeks. Pro Football Focus put together their top five pass catching duos in the NFL right now. And number five on that list happened to be none other than AJ Green and Tyler Boyd. And it was impressive to me because the list not only was just receivers, but it included receivers, running backs, tight ends. And in 2019, you know, passing has never been more important than the NFL. And the saturation of the receiving talent pool and the pass catching running back talent pool and the tight end talent pool has never been greater. You know, you have lower level coaches that are asking, you know, receivers at the bottom of the depth chart to move the cornerback because, you know, there's so much talent at that position and there's not enough bodies to defend them. So in today's NFL, if you have a top five pass catching duo, that's something that definitely needs to be commended for. And just looking at the rest of the list in this order, it went number one, Adam Thielen and Stephon Diggs for the Vikings, which I think objectively is probably the best 1-2 punch you have in the NFL. Number two was actually a fellow AFC North team, Odell Beckham Jr. and Jarvis Landry. They haven't actually played together yet, but they already took the number two spot. Number three was Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce of the Chiefs. We don't even know how many games Tyreek Hill is going to play this year, if he's going to play at all, but Travis Kelce is pretty clearly the best tight end in the game with the retirement of Rob Gronkowski. And number four is Michael Thomas and Alvin Kamara. So, Anthony, I think there's, aside from number one, but that's just kind of my opinion, there's a lot of debate with where you would even place AJ Green and Tyler Boyd here, because for starters, you know, Green and Boyd have only really played together and dominated together for 1 year. Boyd had an impressive rookie season for rookie standards, but he definitely wasn't at the level of 2018 that he was on. And even then, you know, you had AJ Green miss seven games. So you really only have a half year of dominance with AJ Green and Tyler Boyd, but here we see them at number five. But you can almost put them ahead of maybe one or two of those other duos. I have two in my mind that I would probably make the best arguments for. But in your opinion, if you had to keep the same five duos here, where would you place Green and Boyd, assuming all the other variables stay?
It is a big compliment because, I mean, you look at the names you mentioned, Thielen Diggs, Beckham Landry, Hill Kelsey, Thomas Kamara, Green and Tyler Boyd. That's a big list. Like you, I'm hard pressed to move them up high. I think talent wise,
that's the key.
Yeah. I mean, I think that argument can easily be made that, hey, that, you know, they could be number two. They could be there's arguments to be made for number one, especially with the fact that, like you said, Green missed almost half a season last year and was tearing it up. Boyd was tearing it up already with Green out of the lineup and just got more looks when Boyd was tearing it up with Green in the lineup and started tearing it up even more with him out of the lineup because he got more looks. There's a lot of arguments that could be made here. The problem is, you know, these guys that are on here just kind of have a longer track record, a bigger sample size of success than those two together. Because if you go back when Green was healthy in 2017, Boyd didn't do much, right? He kind of had actually a decrease from his rookie year in 2016. So, and then in 2016, he had a nice year as a rookie player, but still didn't have the type of statistics that he had last year. So the sample size is kind of small, and the sample size, like you said, with them together and producing at a high level is kind of small. So I could see an argument where you could say, hey, I mean, they could be above, they could be at number three, but especially with Tyreek Hill and all of his weird stuff going on off the field that could affect things going forward for him. I mean, there's an argument there. You know, Alvin Kamara, great weapon. You could make some arguments there. Beckham and Landry, they played together in college. They haven't shared the football yet with the Browns, like everything and everybody else. They are crowning the Cleveland Browns. There's a lot of arguments to be made here. I think five is fair for a number of different things. I do want to point this stat out, John, and I want to ask you the same question you asked me, but this is an eye-popping statistic. Boyd actually led the league's receivers who saw at least 45 targets in that span with a 134.1 passer rating. And that is with Andy Dalton, whatever your thoughts are on him, and that is with Jeff Driscoll, I think, in terms of that span that they're talking about. That's a very, very impressive statistic, and that makes him a quarterback's best friend. And the fact that he could do a little bit on the outside, he does the dirty work on the inside. I think that is something to be marveled at. And hopefully last year wasn't the outlier. It was that big pivotal third year that propels him moving forward. But your thoughts on if fair ranking, do you have a specific or solid argument for them to be higher on that list?
Well, first of all, I think it is definitely a fair rating. Just to be here, I think is extremely commendable for them. And it's very fair because you can order this list in numerous different ways. But I think you harped on like my first big point, like the fact that, you know, how much of their production should be inflated with probably the second worst or maybe even the worst quarterback on this list for the teams that are listed. And that's just relative to the teams that were listed, because with the Chiefs, you have Patrick Mahomes, who's obviously better. The Saints had Drew Brees. He's a future Hall of Famer. Even the Browns, Baker Mayfield's incredibly impressive and might have more natural ability than Dalton. And then the Vikings have a pretty comparable one in Kirk Cousins. So when you compare Dalton to all those, you have to think, okay, it's even more impressive for the production that AJ Green consistently produces. And just like you said, it was incredible with what Tyler Boyd did in his third year, especially with playing with Jeff Driscoll for half the year and producing the efficiency numbers that he did produce. So that's definitely something that should help them out. And then I also just started looking, like comparing the receivers individually and looking at, like, you know, who's the number one, who's the number two in this scenario. And I think you can make the argument that AJ Green might be just be the the most naturally gifted receiver, who's the number one option out of this. You know, maybe you can have an argument for Tyreek Hill because he's just more explosive and you can do a couple more things with him in numerous parts of the field. But I think still you would probably take AJ Green as just an all-around receiver over a Michael Thomas, probably over both Thielen and Diggs. And, you know, and I think he's pretty much in the same tier as Beckham. I'm not going to make the full-fledged argument that either one is better than that. But then you compare Tyler Boyd to like the secondary options. Probably Thielen or Diggs is better than him. I think there's a clear argument that the average NFL fan would probably rather have the receiver in Tyler Boyd than the receiver in Jarvis Landry. And I know Landry's production speaks for himself and the type of niche role that he's in. But I think in terms of natural ability, there's more that you can do with Tyler Boyd. And then, you know, it's hard to compare him to Travis Kelce because he's the best tight end in the game. So you could probably put Boyd behind him. And then Alvin Kamara, I mean, one of, if not the best receiving backs in the NFL, but you can do more with Boyd down the field. So you probably take him just relative to the players that are listed. So when you're looking at comparing guys from an individual standpoint, there's a clear argument where you can have, you know, the Bengals over the Browns in this scenario or even over the Saints. So I think anywhere in that 3 to 5 range is probably the most accurate. Maybe like I would probably go 3, I guess. I would keep the Vikings at the top with Thielen, Diggs. I would put the Chiefs with Tyreek and Kelce there. And then I might have like a 3A, 3B relationship with the Saints and the Bengals. And then I would probably put the Browns at 5 just because, you know, Landry doesn't really scare me that much. The potential chemistry that he can have with Beckham is definitely dangerous, and the relationship that those two share is definitely notable. But I just think from all the receivers and the pass catchers on this list, Landry is the one that scares me the least. And I think, again, Beckham is very comparable in terms of talent and production with Green. He's in that same elite tier still. So I think 3 or 4 is probably where you would probably put them. But again, I'm not in any way upset with putting them at 5. I still think it's an impressive accomplishment to be even recognized with this group because, again, there's so many great pass-catching duos in the NFL because the NFL is just filled with so many great receivers and receiving running backs and tight ends. So the fact that the Bengals have both these guys and they're both up for extensions should make this a no-brainer when it comes to August.
Yeah, and the other thing, and I think it was maybe T. Martin in our – and not that T. Martin, I don't think – in the live YouTube chat said something to the effect of trios, you know, receiving trios. I mean – that's the one caveat to this thing. I mean, if you look at those teams, maybe the Browns, based on having some guys, Njoku and Callaway and, you know, Duke Johnson, and, you know, they've got guys who could catch the ball at a lot of different spots. I mean, the Bengals, John Ross puts stuff together. He can catch the ball. Mixon and Geo, they can catch the ball well. Eifert's healthy. He can catch the ball. Uzama, he can catch the ball. I mean, the Bengals – depth-wise as well, aside from those top two guys, they've got guys that can catch the ball from a lot of different spots, which, going back to what we were talking about earlier, bodes well for Zach Taylor in the offense that he's trying to create, potentially a McVay type of offense for the Bengals. So all in all, John, I mean, all of a sudden kind of a flurry of compliments have come this way. And I to tie a bow on this, I guess, Is this something that you're buying into? Is this idle chatter because it's a little bit of a slower part of the NFL calendar and they just want to kind of talk about all teams at this point to pique interest? Or is this something where all of a sudden pundits, media members, they've heard the chatter from the players and the energy from the players, the new energy. They've actually seen some of the on-field work. Granted, it's in helmets and shorts. They've seen some of the on-field work and go, wow, that's right. They have that guy. Oh, yeah, that's right. They're deep at that position too. And all of a sudden now, a little bit of momentum. If you remember last year, that's kind of what happened last year to some degree, right? I mean, nobody thought they were going to be very good. And then all of a sudden they started seeing practices as training camp opened. Then they went 3-1 in the preseason and were playing very well. The starters were playing very well. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, people may want to look out for this team. So is it a similar type of thing finally happening, or is this kind of just people talking?
I think it's a combination of the subjective factors that we kind of always hear mixed with the objective factors with the data on their side. Because, like, for once, I think you can finally say that something might be different just because Marvin Lewis isn't here and the familiar faces he has on staff and on the roster aren't here anymore. So anything that you might hear, you know, how things are different, I think you can actually somewhat believe at this point, because in the past couple of years, I just refused to believe that, even if I always heard it from the same, you know, sources. So, you know, the usual sayings with a team that gets a new staff and, you know, a reinvigorated energy with the team, like that just comes to the territory, and it's not the thing that really puts the team over the top. I just think that there is also objectively solid reasons of why this team could bounce back and be actually good. And that was the two that I mentioned earlier. They're going to be just naturally healthier this year because that's just the law of regression. And I just think there's going to be definite games when they're not going to have Jeff Driscoll playing quarterback, and Andy Dalton is going to lead them to a couple more just one score games. And they don't need to be perfect in those games, because if they're perfect, then there's probably going to be a rude awakening the year afterwards. But I think they're going to just be better and just win a couple more games that they should have won last year, just because they're going to be healthier and just things are just going to go their way this time, because that's just kind of how it happens in the NFL, where, you know, things change so frequently, and teams who are unlucky one year typically end up just being a little bit luckier next year. So with health and with just things bouncing the right way with the talent that they have, I think there is a case for this team to make a quiet playoff push. And I think that's just invokes what a sleeper in June is all about.
Yep. And we've kind of been saying it as fans. We've been saying it as a website at cincyjungle.com. And now some other people are finally opening their ears and talking about it. So, after a lot of an off season kind of filled with question marks, an off season kind of filled with, I think, inside our own little who day bubble, we'd like to think that things are turning around. But now some of that outside chatter of negativity has turned a little bit. This is the Orange and Black Insider Bengals podcast. I'm Anthony Cazenza. He's John Sheeran. We are aware a little bit of a video issue going on for the live viewers on YouTube. Not exactly sure what happened. We are working to fix that, so stick with us if you're joining us live, or if you end up watching this video after the fact. At a minimum, you get to hear our beautiful voices, and we'll try and figure all that out. But you can also get this show and all of our other mini episodes and things we do on this program. You can get it on iTunes. You can get it on Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, Megaphone. As I mentioned, the website, cincyjungle.com. All of our stuff is on there. And YouTube, even though for some reason video isn't working for the first part of this episode. But we'll try and figure that out. But thanks for downloading. How you do? Thanks for tuning in. However you get our show, and thanks for subscribing to all of our channels.
So, in the spirit of optimism, I was thinking that with players coming back from injury, with players going into pivotal years in their careers, I think this is the right time to put together some over/under prop bets for the Bengals offense, and maybe even a defender or two. So, for starters, Let's just go through the depth chart here. Let's just go through from quarterback to whatever. So starting with Andy Dalton, Anthony, do you think over or under 23 touchdowns?
Yeah. So this segment's for the bettors out there, right?
Yeah.
Hey, you can do a lot of fun things with this, I guess. You can play a drinking game, I guess. You can put some money down, whatever you want to do. So you said 23 touchdowns, right?
23 touchdowns.
Yeah, so we came up with that number, I think, because on average in his career, Andy Dalton is basically throwing 23.5 touchdown passes per season. That's the average.
He threw 25 in like 13 games or 12 games back in 2015 too.
Right. Right, and then, of course, numbers were affected last year as well because the season was cut short. So I will say over, and I will say over because I don't foresee Dalton getting hurt again this year. I don't see him getting benched either. I see this offense working well for him, but I think if it's over, it's barely over because the team will want to run the ball a lot. I think some of those touchdowns will be, I don't want to use the word cheap, but they could be short yardage, goal line type of, you know, dump offs to the back or tight end, that sort of thing, to kind of pad the stats a little bit. But I think it would be barely over 23.
Okay. And that last point is kind of interesting to me, because I'm thinking if this is going to really like mirror what the Rams are doing, like Todd Gurley was so effective in the red zone as a runner. Like he had 17 touchdowns and they were all in the red zone. I think Joe had, I think, 8 with one coming outside the red zone. I could be wrong with that. Someone could definitely fact check me for that. But I think Joe Mixon is going to see more opportunities as a runner in the red zone, which might decrease some of the touchdown opportunities that Dalton has. And this could definitely be like a fantasy outlook as well. But 23 over 16 is about like 1.5. And just looking at like the guys he's throwing to, like when Eifert's on the field, he's one of the best red zone threats in the NFL. But you can only really count him for being on the field for less than 50% of the games. So say he gets like just a handful. You have AJ getting like his usual like 8 to 10. Tyler Boyd getting somewhere in the range of like, you know, 6 or 7. Maybe a little bit less for John Ross from last year's 7. So you add all those up, that's right around like the mid to low 20s, or maybe even the high 20s. So I think that mid 20 range is pretty safe, and I think this would be definitely an intriguing just prop if it was official. I'm gonna say it just like you, over but barely over, because I think Mixon is gonna have a lot easier time in the red zone getting those scoring opportunities and you know, not being stopped at the goal line because the Bengals are condensing everything and making it obvious that they're gonna run. But yeah, I think if he plays all 16 games, he's gonna average probably just over 1.5 touchdowns per game, because I think his career is like 1.6 per 16 games. So I'm gonna say barely over with that as well. So our next one, we have the running back Joe Mixon, who last year had just about 1,500 yards from scrimmage. And that's about for how many games he played. I think it was a little bit over 100 yards per game. And that was honestly, putting it frankly, that was with him being largely misused as a receiver. You know, he has natural receiving talent. He has the ability to line up from the slot and, you know, to take passes down the field. So I think you're going to see a definite increase in usage for him as a receiver and just increase effectiveness as a receiver. So I think 1600 would be a proper, just going with 100 per game would be a proper, you know, borderline to set. But also, you know, there comes the question of, is he going to be rotated in more with Giovanni Bernard? Are they going to keep him fresh? Are they going to keep him fresh for a potential playoff run? Are they going to, you know, rotate him more and more as the season goes on, so they don't want to have what happened to Todd Gurley? So while the touchdowns may increase, maybe the overall usage decreases, but still 100 yards from scrimmage per game for Mixon, is that too much or too little? What are you going with?
Oh boy. Again, this has to do with, this would have to do with health also. He was out a couple of games with that knee scope. You mentioned the usage. I think just because the team is going to be run heavy, I think that's doable. And I think he has proven, Brian Baldinger of NFL Network kind of broke down some video recently. I think it was on Twitter and on the website itself. He broke down some video talking about how he thinks Mixon could lead the league in rushing and potentially all-purpose yards. And I think that has to do with health. What's interesting, and you can see it on the video breakdowns by him and many others, Mixon creates a lot of big plays with poor blocking.
Mm-hmm.
And has done so really in his first two seasons, especially at times last year. So I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that he is, he's getting over 100 yards per game from scrimmage. Maybe, especially if other guys stay healthy, maybe the receiving yards go down a little bit. But I think they're gonna work him.
Yeah, and that's definitely that's the main question. Like, how much are they going to work him? Because I think when you look at the landscape of running backs in terms of who can be a bell cow, I think Mixon is right up there with guys who can take 20 touches a game and still be fresh because he's just that type of athlete. I just think that with what Taylor saw happen with Todd Gurley last year and how they, you know, had to lean on CJ Anderson, who fortunately had a great year for them because the run blocking was so good. I think that's kind of going to be influenced with what they do with Mixon and the fact that they drafted two running backs, two very capable running backs. I think there's going to be more rotation that we see just to keep Mixon fresh. So I think the efficiency is going to be there, if not even better than what we saw last year, because the run blocking, I think, is going to be just marginally better, if not slightly better. But I'm going to say just barely under, and not because I think the receiving is going to go up, but I think the rushing isn't going to go up as much as we think. But I will say, I think he scores more rushing touchdowns than he did last year, which was, I think, nine or so. So, like, and again, like, if you finish this with, say, like 1,000 rushing yards, 400 receiving yards, I think that's still a really good season. And, you know, on somewhere around like less than 300 touches, overall touches, that's still, you know, a great average per touch for in terms of yards per touch. So I think the efficiency is going to be there, but maybe not the volume that people are expecting. Yeah, so now,
Nine, so just go. Real quick, nine total touchdowns. You look at his numbers. I mean, almost 4.9 yards a carry, almost 1,200 yards rushing, nine total touchdowns, led the AFC in rushing yards, and didn't make the Pro Bowl. I mean, I don't understand what more the guy had to do. But anyways, go ahead.
All right, so this one could potentially shock some people, but we set the over-under for AJ Green receiving yards at 1,000. Now, 1,000 is something that he almost hit in 2016 when he missed six games, that he wasn't that close to this year, last year because he missed more games, but he's hit over 1,000 receiving yards when he's played the vast majority of any season in the eight seasons that he's played. We said 1,000, though, because there could be more equal distribution with how the ball is going to be spread out in this offense. You have to think that John Ross's receiving yards are going to go up. You have to think that Tyler Boyd's going to be around the 1,000, the 800 to 900 range as well. You would like to think that Tyler Boyd can be more implemented in the offense, or as long as he stays healthy. And then you have guys like Sample and Uzoma taking touches away. And again, like we said, Mixon should be used more effectively as a receiver, and Giovanni Bernard is still there. He can catch the ball as well. So as long as there's enough bodies for Taylor to utilize and Dalton to throw to, the opportunity for Green to really hit like with the rest of the elite receivers in terms of receiving yards, like a Julio Jones or DeAndre Hopkins, it goes down. And it's not that Green can hit that, because obviously he's shown he can, but if everybody stays healthy, I think he's going to be closer to 1,000 yards than people may think, because you can always count on him for getting in that 1,100 to 1,300 range. But again, if everyone stays healthy, I think it's very likely that this offense will do a lot in its power to not force feed the ball to him, because other guys are getting more advantageous opportunities to get the ball. So over under 1,000 yards.
I like the Dalton thing. I'm going to say over, but barely. I mean, I put up a post that was having to do with our show last week on Cincy Jungle, and basically the question was, what should we expect from AJ Green in terms of statistical output? 63% said more of the same greatness, which is what you said, probably that 1,100, 1,200, 1,300 yard range, which we've become accustomed to when he's healthy. Only 9% said a decline because of multiple factors, and 29% his greatest year. Yeah, John, you mostly talked about the plethora of weapons that the Bengals could use and all of that. There is the health factor. You know, the fact that he's getting over 30, and I think he's going to be 31 by the time the season starts. And we know that receivers, as they get into their 30s, even ones as good as AJ Green, their production can dip a little bit. I think that they will still give Green a lot of looks, but like you, I don't think they will force feed him as much. I think he'll still get a lot of looks, but I think he'll probably be kind of barely over the 1,000. I don't see an injury striking him again, at least not in the way. Maybe he'll miss a game or two, but I don't see him, you know, missing the 6, 7, 8 games or something that he has the past, like last year and a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I think over is definitely the safer one, because as long as he plays 16 games, it's hard to imagine he's not averaging at least 60 receiving yards per game, because you think like he's averaging like 15 a catch, probably getting at least 4 catches a game. So 1,000 would probably be like the bare minimum if everything goes right. But I do think that if everything clicks, there's more of a possibility now that he gets under with everything else going right around him than it was in years past. So we're going to do one more, and it's not an offensive player this time. It's a defensive player in Jesse Bates, who had, I want to say, how many interceptions did he have last year? 3 or 4?
I think he had 3. Let me double check. He may have had 4.
Yeah, so he had 3. So 4.
Yeah, later. And I think Sean Williams had 4.
Right.
Yeah.
Which honestly, a Bengals defender getting more than one interception in a year is a miracle in itself. Yeah. But yeah, Bates definitely had that 8-week stretch in the beginning of the season when he was a legitimate candidate for rookie of the year, and presumably under a more simplistic defensive scheme under Lou Anarumo, you would like to think that he gets more acclimated and comfortable leading this defense and leading the secondary in itself, and maybe with a more potent pass rush, you have more errant passes over the middle. And again, you would like to see a positive progression in Bates' game, because where he is right now is already at a great level, and he's talented and athletic. So hopefully you would like to see him take a next step this year in potentially a better defensive scheme. So over under 4 interceptions for Bates this year.
Over or under, huh? I can't stand.
I was going to say push 2, but I'm not going to do that.
Okay. I'll say under. The 4 interceptions is a lot. It really is. I don't think he can do it. I just think that, you know, again, he might be just under that, maybe a 2 or 3 interception season. Interestingly enough, though, Pro Football Focus yesterday put out a tweet. He was the second among rookies in terms of yards per snap allowed. He's a good football player. That was a very good pick for a guy that wasn't really on a lot of people's radar until really up until the draft last year. Mm-hmm. I don't think he'll get 4 this year. I'd like to see an increase in turnovers in general from the defense, but I think he'll kind of be in that 2 to 3 range. And that's fine. If other guys step up and get turnovers, I think everybody would take that. I think everybody notes that he played well last year.
Yeah, and I think that the two factors that are important here is that quality secondary play from an individual standpoint and from a team standpoint is hard to maintain from year to year. It's harder to do than like a solid pass rush, but quality secondary play can be even more important to a defense's success. So I think that the overall team number of interceptions is going to go up from just natural regression. I think William Jackson is going to get more opportunities, maybe even Drake or Patrick Lux into one because it bounces off some dude's head or something like that. I think Sean Williams is going to get his. I think Bates is still going to be able to find the ball. I think 4 might be pushing it. Like, again, I would love to say 4, but I think 3 or 2 is probably a comfortable guess for this year because there's only so many interceptions for a team to have, and I don't think this is going to be some 2018 Bears or 2017 Jaguars defense by any means or anything like that. So I think 3 or 2 is probably safe. So I'm going to join you with under as well.
Okay. I've got one more for, it's the same number for 2 different players. And we can maybe end on this one if you are okay with that, John.
Let's do it.
So I have for, this number will be for both Carlos Dunlap and Geno Atkins. It's in the category of sacks. So I'm looking at 8 sacks for each of them for the season. I say that. I'm saying that because Dunlap has averaged just over 8 sacks per year in his career.
Right.
He had 8. You look at the last 3 seasons, 8 sacks, 7.5 sacks, 8 sacks. So he is particularly difficult to read on this one. But what do you think about eight sacks, especially now that he's entering his 10th season?
I think eight's too much for Dunlap. I think we've probably seen the best of him in terms of an athleticism standpoint and just the best of him as a pass rusher. I'm not saying it's going to be a full-blown Michael Johnson drop-off where he's just a two-down player, but I think in terms of providing pressure, he's still going to be about what he is. But in terms of finishing pressure, that was always like the main thing that we harped on him in terms of just overall consistency as a pass rusher. He only had that one incredible year back in 2015 where he had like 12 or 13. Everything besides that has been, you know, hovering around 8 to 10. I just think that, you know, he's not going to completely fall off the cliff, but I think he's at the apex right now, just on the way down a little bit. I think A would be probably a good max for him, but I'm going to say probably around 6 or 7. So under for Dunlap.
I will also say under. I think that is a difficult number to reach, especially when you're a 10th year defensive lineman. I think he might be more in the 6 to 7 range there, but I will say under. Sorry, Carlos. What about Geno Atkins? These two guys basically are 1-2 all time in career sacks. Geno Atkins has just a tiny bit less than Carlos Dunlap. Carlos Dunlap has kind of been, you know, right around that 8-9 mark almost throughout his entire career, where Geno Atkins has been closer to the double digits most of his career, but then he'll have the occasional year where he has 3 sacks, 6 sacks, you know, that sort of thing. So right. Last 4 years for Geno, 11 sacks, 9 sacks, 9 sacks, and then 10 sacks last year. Do you think 8 sacks is too much or too little for Geno Atkins this year?
I'm more confident in Geno hitting that than I am with Dunlap. And it's weird to say because he is an interior rusher and Dunlap goes off the edge, typically off the right edge. And I'm kind of contradicting myself a little bit because I'm like prematurely predicting a slight downfall for Dunlap, but I'm not ready to do that for Geno because I just think, you know, they're always paired with each other in terms of just, you know, leading that defense, coming from the same draft class and just being equally effective in terms of raw stats. But I think just from an individual standpoint, Geno has just always been a next level special player compared to Dunlap, especially at a position where it's harder to produce production and sacks from his standpoint. You know, where he is with the rest of the elite three techniques in the game probably is more questionable now than it was a couple years ago. But until I do see the decline from Geno, I think, you know, 8 to 9 sacks is definitely a safer bet with him than it is for Dunlap. You know, last year, very similar to a guy like Carl Lawson, he was getting a lot of pressure, but just wasn't finishing it. And that was also, you know, having to do with just the way that, you know, the game scripts were going against the Bengals and where teams were just running the ball later in the game, just not having those pass rushing opportunities and just, you know, teams picking apart defenses that had nothing to do with the pass rush. So if the defense gets better, I think naturally you're going to have your pass rushers getting more, you know, ample opportunities to get those sacks. And until I do see the downfall for a truly elite player in Geno Atkins, I'm going to assume he maintains in that near elite production with probably 8 or 9 sacks. So I'm going to go just over.
All right. Kendall Morgan says over for Geno in the live YouTube chat. That is Brown Shoe 72 says under. And I think that was in reference to the Jesse Bates number for the interceptions. So, you know, there's some opinions out there, but hey, we're having a little fun with this. We know that football is a bettors sport, and a lot of people like to bet on a lot of different things. So we thought we'd have a little fun and talk about some over and under. And really, these are kind of realistic numbers, and that's what made it tough to bet either way. And it's based on averages throughout these guys' career and all kinds of different stuff.
Yeah, Anthony had to talk me out of putting 2,000 yards for Joe Mixon, you know, 1,500 yards for AJ Green, like 10 interceptions for Jesse Bates. So he's the one who made those realistic, not me.
Yeah, I'm the voice of reason on this show for sure. No, I'm not. This is the Orange and Black Insider Bengals podcast. He's John Sheeran. I'm Anthony Cazenza. We're having some fun talking some potential over-under bets with the Bengals and their statistical production. We talked a bit about the positivity that's coming from the national media when it comes to the Cincinnati Bengals. All of a sudden, they're this sleeper team, according to some folks, especially over at the NFL Network, NFL.com. And, you know, maybe they're listening to all of us and the players talking about, hey, don't forget about us. Don't, you know, pay attention to us. You can get this program on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on Google Play. You can get it on Megaphone, CincyJungle.com, and YouTube. Our apologies for the live listeners who were expecting to see some video. We tried to do a couple of different things, and apparently all you saw was John's face and the OBI logo. Throughout,
which is all you need to see.
Well, really, it really is better than my face. So I don't really know what happened. We tried tinkering with a couple of different things. We'll figure it out. We haven't really lost video before. We've had other hiccups in this show, but it is what it is. We appreciate those of you who stuck around, and even though we didn't have video, but you know, you can still get to our channel on YouTube and listen to the show as well as on all of our audio platforms. I did want to say before we'll get to some final thoughts here. We just got a text a little bit ago from, I think it was from Ken Dipple, who is in the live YouTube chat as well, saying he's got two good tickets for the Ravens game on November 10th at Paul Brown Stadium that he's looking to sell. They're right in the middle of goalposts and good seats apparently. So if you are interested in buying those, we can connect you to Ken or get in touch with him in the live YouTube chat. He's also here on a lot of different episodes that we record. So, and thank you, Ken, for that. So get in touch with him. And if you're interested in those tickets, heck, I may even take him up on that. I don't know. But I thought I'd at least throw him a solid and see if he can unload those on some willing Bengals fan. Not to Ravens fans, though. The invitation is closed to them. Any final thoughts, John?
I actually there was one game where I've been to plenty of Bengals games, but there was one game where I did sit behind the goalpost, and it was the game where Carson Palmer came back with the Raiders. And there was a lot of good memories from that game, but I distinctly remember there was one Bengals fan who sat like three rows behind me, and I'm sure there's plenty of fans who sit like in any section of the stadium, in any stadium really in the league, but he was so ungodly convinced that he could like affect the cadence for Palmer, and he would always scream "Hut, Hut!" And there's like I think he screamed "Hut" a little over 3,000 times during the game, and it was just me and my dad sitting there. We're just laughing our butts off just at this guy who was just I think he had like shoulder pads too. Like when me and him went to games, it would always be in the same section. We'd like know the people around. They were very mild mannered people, but you go down to the lower bowl of PBS, and it for me it was just a whole nother experience. So good seats there. Hopefully you see Hut man, guy who can convince the cadence. But if not, you know, still good seats, I would assume.
Well, that was quite the selling point for the tickets there, John. I'm sure. No, it happens everywhere though. There's always quote unquote that guy everywhere. Just a little more tolerable when it's a guy rooting for the team that you care about or you're rooting for, right? But yeah, it happens everywhere. And like I said, if any of you folks are interested, we can connect you with Ken or any of that, because that's what we do. We're connectors of people. That's what we do. We bring Bengals fans together on this show. Thanks everyone for tuning in. We may do a listener question segment show again this Friday. We'll keep you updated on that, schedule permitting. Otherwise, we'll wait a week and get to that next week. But keep it to our Twitter feed at BengalsOBI and CincyJungle.com to get some alerts on that. We'll let you know. It would probably be a Friday afternoon / evening for the early evening for the East Coast time folks. So, yeah, we'll let you know, but for now that's going to do it for us. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading the program. We'll see you next time. For John Sheeran, I'm Anthony Cazenza. This has been the Orange and Black Insider Bengals Podcast.